Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720. Chicago, it's Justin Kaufman. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Excited to be with you tonight till 10 o'clock. Beautiful night. 18 stories high atop the mouth of the Chicago River, looking out Lake Michigan, Navy Pier. It's a beautiful night. We've had a nice stretch of beautiful nights here in Chicago. We hope to keep that going throughout the weekend at least. Lots to do tonight on the program. Got a lot to talk about. Coming up in the 7:30 segment, we're going to talk about guns. Let's talk about guns, gun rights, gun legislation. The Illinois State Rifle Association believes that the laws that are on the books, especially the laws that were just passed by Governor Pritzker, are illegal. They filed suit against them, namely because of the regulations that it puts on small businesses and gun dealers in the state of Illinois. But the other question may not even really be about the legality, but it's about the ethics of it. It's the same piece of legislation that was passed in during, I want to say, the last year, so 2018, of Governor Bruce Rauner's tenure. They sent the piece of legislation to Rauner in May, and he vetoed it. This is well known. We all remember this. In the fall, they re-voted. They put it back through. They voted. That's not uncommon. They were able to pass it again. But this time, State Senate President John Cullerton did not send it to the governor's office. Instead, he held it until, of course, the new governor, Governor Pritzker, a Democrat, was elected. And when his term began, one of the first things he did was sign this gun legislation into law. And that, you know, again, they probably could have done that at the beginning of the tenure. They could have, you know, it's not like they didn't have the votes to do that. So Cullerton and Madigan could have actually pushed this through during the session that was just this year in 2019. But this was a holdover from 2018. It's somewhat unprecedented to hold over from one session to another. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. But more importantly, what are we going to do about guns? Because as we saw in California just earlier this week and this past weekend, the Garlic Festival, it's not stopping. And so the question becomes, if you're not going to have sort of sweeping legislation that's going to come from the federal government, states have to jump in. And as we saw with the state of Illinois, that's what they did. And when you look at the actual law, the law is really about trying to make it really, really expensive to be in the gun dealing business. And that's what the ISRA, the Illinois State Rifle Association, contends is discriminatory. So we'll talk with Richard Pearson from the Illinois Rifle Association coming up here at 7:30. I'm fascinated about it. I don't know. You know, I've never really weighed in, and it's not been something that I feel like I have a huge, you know, part of expertise, if you will. And so it's great to have somebody in here, especially when we talk about such a contentious issue when it comes to guns, gun control, and gun rights. And so to have somebody in here, we're going to have a conversation coming up at 7:30. I'm looking forward to it. 312-981-7200 if you would like to get in on that. That's coming up at 7:30. At 8 o'clock, we're going to turn our attention to whistleblowers. Catherine Gunn is one of the more, I would say, names that people are not familiar with. That is one of the biggest whistleblowers of our time. She was working for the equivalent of the British NSA. She came across a memo right before the Iraq War. In that memo, it showed the United States was asking the British NSA to spy on members of the UN Security Council and to find out any information they could find that could help them twist arms or blackmail those members so that they would vote for resolution for war in Iraq. This was obviously some evidence that the U.S. was manufacturing or marketing an attempt to go to war in Iraq, that the weapons of mass destruction or what they were trying to say was happening in the war wasn't actually happening, or the lead up to the war. So Catherine Gunn took it to a friend took it to the papers, and the rest is history. As if you remember this, the Observer, the British paper at the time, printed the story as a big bombshell, and it continues to play out, of whether or not the war in Iraq was actually a legitimate war. And we're going to talk about that with Catherine Gunn. She is in studio because her story has been made into a movie called Official Secrets. Catherine Gunn is played by Keira Knightley. Film is coming out this next month, and we're going to talk with her about it. Catherine Gunn. Helena Hampton is a whistleblower as well. She came forward, allegations of sexual harassment at the hands of operative in the Mike Madigan organization, Kevin Quinn. This was back in 2018. This started a movement in Springfield. We're going to change the laws. Mike Madigan stepped up. He said it's courageous for her to come forward. There has been legislation in Springfield that has changed the way that they approach sexual harassment, task force, everything in between. It came out last week. The Tribune came out that Kevin Quinn, although he was fired from Madigan's organization, was getting under the table payments for lobbying work. And it just begs the question whether or not that was how they decided to take care of those allegations, because Helena Hampton hasn't worked since in the state of Illinois. And she has other things. I don't know exactly what she does for a living, but the point being that she feels that she has been blacklisted, blackballed out of Illinois politics. She rarely talks. She's on with us tonight. Tell her story and what she thinks about the story that came out in the Chicago Tribune last week about Kevin Quinn. That's coming up at 8 o'clock. 9 o'clock, we'll take a deep breath and we'll talk about one of the most underappreciated soul singers of our time, Donnie Hathaway. You may know Donnie Hathaway. Pete and I, our favorite Christmas song, This Christmas. Great. Donnie Hathaway, Chicago-born soul singer. Really, he died tragically. They say it was suicide in 1979. But in the 70s, Donnie Hathaway, along with Roberta Flack and others, he was one of the preeminent soul singers who came up through Curtis Mayfield's record label. I mean, he was some of the songs, you hear the songs, I was listening to them as we were getting ready for this segment, just really iconic songs. Donnie Hathaway is going to be remembered in tribute at Millennium Park on Monday. And our buddy Mario Smith, and you know Mario's been on the program many a times, Mario's behind it. He's helping make sure that the world, and specifically Chicago, Donny Hathaway's hometown, remembers Donny Hathaway. We'll have that conversation about his music and why put together this tribute at Millennium Park coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And then we'll finish with, I think, a great conversation, a business conversation, about when it's time to change your logo. When is it time to change your logo? When you've put all this time and effort and branding into a logo and it's not working, what do you do? And how do you do it? We'll have a brand conversation about your logo. It's kind of like the old segment we used to download on Chicago Business, and we still air on Steve Cochran's show and Rokan, but this is something that's a little more extended, and we'll talk about that concept coming up as well. So all those stories to get to on Extension 720. My brain hurts right now. Luckily, Pete Zimmerman's here if it gets too heady, right? You're ready to go to step in if I need to step out and get a glass of water or some Tang or something like that. Also, a beautiful view here in Chicago and a beautiful night will keep us energized and ready for what's ahead. All right, coming up, Extension 720 with you till 10 o'clock here on 720 WGN. Coming up, the Illinois State Rifle Association will be in studio. Conversation about guns and about the legislation that was passed at the beginning of the Pritzker tenure, back at the beginning of as one of the first things he did when he became governor. So we'll have that conversation coming up right after the 7:30 news. As you may have heard, Bill and Wendy are going to be out the McHenry County State Fair coming up, or soon, right? The McHenry State Fair. I believe that's coming up next week. Tomorrow? Is it tomorrow? Pete says it's tomorrow. I'm a little bit hurt that I was not asked to be a part of that, since that's my hometown, right? McHenry County, McHenry. I grew up in Wonder Lake, Illinois. I feel like I've won a couple of mirrors by throwing darts at the at balloons, a Bon Jovi mirror, maybe a Jack Daniels mirror.
Right.
I have all that stuff. I feel like I spent a lot of time going there on a Friday night, Saturday night, going to Woodstock. I think it was in Woodstock where the McHenry County Fair was.
Zip out there in the afternoon.
This is Lollapalooza traffic. It's really hard to get around.
It's not the right way. It's
no,
totally
but it's,
the opposite
it's,
direction.
No, but I mean, it's just Lollapalooza in general. There's just all over the place. And, you know, it's just getting to the expressway, you got to go past Michigan Avenue. I don't know if it's possible. Yeah, but they're going out there tomorrow. You got to listen to that broadcast.
I saw where they, and I don't know much about it. I didn't really research it.
Mm-hmm.
But on the surface, it seems bad.
Uh-oh.
Where there is one of the attractions at your so-called McHenry County is monkeys riding dogs.
What? No way.
Unless I was being, I don't know, I was dreaming.
I mean, Bill is a clever, witty guy. Maybe he's making
making a joke.
I mean, maybe, but there's nothing wrong with a monkey riding a dog.
It seems cruel to the monkey and the dog.
Well, I don't know.
How you think the monkey's just sitting on there like he's a cowboy? Yeah, I'm sure he's chained to the dog.
So you're saying animal cruelty is the issue?
Yeah.
I thought maybe they just didn't like each other as species, and they're like, this is not cool. Oh. I don't want this monkey on my back. Were they going for like a monkey on my back kind of vibe?
I don't know.
Are they races, or are they just, is it kind of like a...
Like I said, I don't know much about it. I'm going to have to look into
you have
it.
To look it up.
But on the surface, I'm saying it's a bad idea, and I if Bill and Wendy weren't there, I might have to boycott.
Well, I have fond memories. I remember one time going to the McHenry Fair, and I had a little Dodge Colt. Take that Dodge Colt, and I had my high school girlfriend, Christine. And I remember we went to the, and I remember King of Wishful Thinking was on the radio. Like, that dates, you know, like, again, I think there's a breakup at the fair. Maybe that's what it was.
Oh, no.
Maybe it was a fair breakup, and then I heard that song, and that's why it stays in my memory banks. Oh. It could have been a fair breakup.
So I see why you don't want to go back.
Yeah, I don't want to go back. It's too painful for the 16-year-old breakups at the fair. Another, you know, you're trying to get the duck in the water, and you're trying to get the big stuffed
right,
animal
yeah.
for her, and you don't, and then she's mad, and you're like, that's it. I'm going to go get my jean jacket. I'm going to roll my jeans. I'm out of here. No, good times out there. Yeah, I don't know where they do it. If the fairgrounds are still, I should ask my parents. They're close by. They're still in Wisconsin now, but the fairgrounds were in Woodstock, so that's where you would go. I don't know if that's where they're going, but yeah. I mean, they could maybe I can do a quick phoner, you know, right at the top. Take away valuable time for them when talking about the fair. I can just take up the first 10, 15 minutes just talking about my experiences with the McHenry County Fair. They should go to Wonder Lake because right about now is when the Wonder Lake ski team doing their thing. You know, I think it was more July, but in August there might be a couple of special shows. You guys have seen the Tommy Bartlett water skiing? Wonder Lake's got that beat. I think of Wonder Lake ski team. I also could be dating myself. They could be long gone. It's been a couple of years since I've been there. They're like, oh, no, they all died in a tragic boat accident. Oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry. No, I think they're still going. Yeah, so listen to Bill and Wendy tomorrow. They're going to be at the McHenry County Fair. How fun. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tonight, let's talk guns. It's a sore subject and one that's back in the news after the mass shooting in California last week. But as many point out, it doesn't really seem to leave the news cycle. Here in Illinois, Governor Pritzker signed a bill into law earlier this year that would put more regulation on gun sellers in the state. But how they got to that point is definitely up for political debate, or in this case, legal. The Illinois State Rifle Association has filed a lawsuit. So where are we on gun regulations in the state of Illinois? Richard Pearson, the executive director of the Illinois State Rifle Association, with me tonight. Mr. Pearson, thanks for coming to the studio. I appreciate it.
Good evening. Glad to be here.
First of all, why are you filing the lawsuit?
Well, there are several reasons. First of all, if you looked at the statistics, so far they've wiped out about 1,211 firearm dealers in the state, which is over half of them. It's
52%. In 6 months.
Yeah, and one day they wiped out that many. And most of them are very small dealers to medium-sized dealers. They serve small communities throughout the state. So these people are just gone. So it actually affects your Second Amendment rights because you have a right to purchase as well as a right to bear arms. You have to be able to get firearms and ammunition. And so it takes all those people right out of the equation.
And that's an interesting thought because was that the intention of this bill? Was the intention to say, you know what, let's have less gun sellers in the state of Illinois?
Well, that wasn't the stated intention, but I believe that was the true intention. You know, we have all kinds of excuses for doing this, but the real intention was to limit the amount of firearms that people can buy, make it harder for them to buy them, and make them more expensive.
It seems to me that that is the straight-up regulation when it comes to what the government can do to take gun control measures, if you will, is to actually make it more expensive, to limit who can sell it, how they sell it, that kind of thing, right?
That's exactly right. But if it happens with firearm dealers, it can happen to anyone.
Right.
So people need to remember that just because you're not in the sights of the government, that doesn't mean you won't be tomorrow.
Okay, I want to come back to that, too, because that's really at the heart of, I think, not just the state of Illinois, but we're seeing that's how states are dealing with their issues on guns and gun control. But the other issue here is a political one, one that is a little bit of a head-scratcher for me and for others that live in the state of Illinois.
Well, that's true. The bill, which was SB 337, was passed in the 101st General Assembly.
Which was last year.
This in the 100th General Assembly. Now it's 101st. Yeah. So Governor Rauner vetoed the bill. It was brought back up, but it was brought back up in the 101st General Assembly. So it passed from one General Assembly to another, which is not supposed to happen. There's a thing called sign die, which all bills die. But this one did not because of the Constitution doesn't address this one way or the other.
So essentially, in May of 2018, they passed it. Governor Rauner vetoed it.
Right.
In the fall, they brought it back up, passed it, did not send it to Governor Rauner.
Right.
They held it. This is a new thing that we've seen both the state Senate president and the Speaker of the House. Instead of sending it for the governor to veto or not veto, they're just holding on to it till the time is right. But in this case, it actually turned over to a whole new administration.
That's correct. You can actually hold a bill if there's technical issues with the bill, but there were no technical issues with this bill. This was political issues. And so it was rammed through in that manner. And it's not illegal. It's probably unethical, but what's that got to do with Springfield, right?
But that, I mean, here we go. We're seeing this kind of play out in the way that the administration works in Washington. We're seeing it now at state level where politicians are finding little loopholes and ways around that may not be necessarily illegal, but they're definitely questionable when it comes to ethics. And this is what happened in the state of Illinois.
That's true. We have a group of people at all legislative levels, whether it's town councils, city councils, Congress, or the state of Illinois, or any other state, that want to micromanage your life, and that's what we're seeing going on right here.
Is there any recourse? Do you feel there's any precedent one way or another that is going to give you an edge when it comes to filing this lawsuit on the grounds of unethical political behavior?
There is no way we can file a lawsuit on unethical political behavior, because if such a thing were to happen, every governmental body would be sued constantly, so we'd all be out of business.
You, as a longtime political player in the state of Illinois, you don't find any beauty in how the Democrats got that through?
Well, you know, it's just a fact of life, and I suppose that when you've been around as long as I have, you get callous to it. You expect it, you know. You expect this kind of I call it political treachery, mm-hmm. but it's one of the things that happens. It's one of the rules of the game, and you have to play in that ballpark because you can't take the ball and go home. It's their ball.
Well, let's talk about this, because at one point I totally understand it. It's a head scratcher, and that's why you're on, because I feel as well that it does fall along unethical standard. It's strange, and I've never heard of holding a bill till a new administration comes in. I didn't think that was even allowed, but it is. But if you're a Democrat leader and you ran on the fact of you wanted to bring some sort of gun control measures to the state of Illinois, you have to see how, if there are ways that are impeding them to get that done, that they are finding loopholes and other ways to get it done.
Well, that's correct. You know, this is one of those things that they've done, you know. So, but we filed suit against this bill, against the implementation of this bill, which will be heard sometime, I hope, soon. But the purpose, we can't file a lawsuit on unethical behavior. There are several things that this violates. We believe it violates the right to keep and bear arms by law-abiding citizens. We are very upset because no law can be put in place in Illinois unless administrative rules are drawn up prior to that with a 90-day comment period. None of that was ever done. There were no rules drawn. There was no 90-day comment period. They just started.
Richard Pearson's my guest. He's the head. He's the executive director of the Illinois State Rifle Association, which is a state chapter of the NRA. Let's take a break. We'll come back, and I want to talk more with Richard Pearson about guns, gun controls, and the state versus federal, because I find that just reading up on this topic, and it's not something that I spend a lot of time looking into, but seeing how many states across the union, they are deciding to take this up because the federal government isn't. It seems to be that might be what's happening here in the state of Illinois. Richard Pearson, my guest here on Extension 720. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Richard Pearson's here. He's the executive director of the Illinois State Rifle Association. We're talking about guns and specifically the legislation that the Rifle Association has filed a lawsuit against the state of Illinois that Governor Pritzker signed back at the beginning of his tenure in 2019 here. As we have more and more political will or people in this country saying something has to be done about guns, we'll just keep it like that. There seems to be a way that the federal government wants it both ways. The federal government doesn't really, you don't see the Senate wanting to take this up. This is not something that they want to touch. And at the same time, they don't necessarily want the states to take it up themselves. And the states have, the workaround has been states are coming up with not unlike what we have here in the state of Illinois. From your vantage point as a state association, how do you see it? Do you think that the federal government should be the ones that are making gun laws and the state should follow suit?
Well, we have a federal system of government, so we have both state and federal government. So both of them can take it up. There's no question about that. They can take up easing gun laws as well as making them more restrictive. Nationally, it is a very volatile issue, and people who run on the anti-gun platform nationally have generally suffered in the end. So it's been the anti-gun idea of the Bloomberg campaign and all their various facets and front groups.
You call it anti-gun?
Anti-gun. They're anti-gun.
You don't think that people would be, like some of that movement, I think of some of the Democratic leaders, don't necessarily send the message that they want guns to go away or they're anti-guns. They just want more control over who gets the gun.
Well, I know, but what they do is they control you out of business. That's the typical thing that happens with governments when they overreach. They control you out of business.
Right.
Years ago in Chicago, when they were running all the gun shops out of Chicago, there was a case in which there was a gun shop in Chicago, and they told the gun shop owner he had to put in a window with bars and glass so the police could see in at night. So he did that. The next year they came back and said, you know, that's a dangerous situation. You have to take it out and brick it all up. And they could never get a restroom to pass inspection, so they harassed you out of business. But just remember, if they can harass one group out of business, they can harass
absolutely.
Every group
and
out
I
of
think
business.
That, but you see it as more of a small business regulation, in the way that these are small businesses and they have the right to make a living in this country, just like any other small business. The government seems to the tack that they're taking when it comes to the lawmakers who are changing gun laws, is that they're saying the only way to affect change is to regulate those small businesses. So how do we affect change if that's the only way the governments are they're not going to go in and say you can't have a gun, but they're going to find other ways around it to try.
Yeah. They're just going to make it difficult, expensive, or embarrassing to have a firearm.
I understand when you say that, but it seems to me like that might be better than legislation that comes in to try and crack the Constitution and change the amendment.
Well, but in the end, the end is firearm ownership is wiped out. So that's what happens in the end with all of this if you let it go. If you look at the federal government, I believe right now more money comes into the federal government through regulation costs and fines than through taxes. And so what they've actually done is they've found a new way to tax that's mm-hmm. unregulated,
yeah.
And that is to charge you. For example, a small gun shop that's open 1 hour a week has to pay a $1,500 license fee, okay? If you're open no hours a week, you just do things on order, it's $300. But with that comes all kinds of camera requirements, security requirements, and they are told, the gun dealers are told that you have to put in cameras and security, but there are no standards for this. So you could spend $20,000, for example, putting in all this equipment, and since there are no standards, they can come in and say, well, you know, you didn't meet the standard, right. But there is no standard.
But the Pritzker administration, their point on this, and it makes sense to me, they say, listen, we know that the federal government, because Rauner vetoed the bill before saying it was duplicative, meaning the federal government already puts these regulations on gun
owners.
They're already doing it. But they said the ATF doesn't have time or resources to come and check the gun dealers. And the gun dealers, when they're unchecked, are the ones that may be doing things out of line, selling guns to people who shouldn't have guns. And the next thing you know, that person is shooting up a school. That's, I think, where their logic is to say. And I understand that logic. As someone who's just a centrist who's talking to you and a layman, I get that logic. So what do you think of that logic?
Well, I think that logic is faulty simply because to buy a firearm in Illinois, you have to have a federal firearm owner's identification card. Every night, FOID card holder goes through a background check except for Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, Easter, and the 4th of July when the courts are closed. If you have a concealed carry permit, you go through two background checks every night. So in Illinois, that's all hokum. If a dealer sells a firearm to a straw purchaser, you know, he's in trouble. He can have his federal license pulled. And if that firearm gets in trouble some way or another, it's traced right back to that dealer.
But the Pritzker administration says that the ATF is not there to be able to get that person in trouble. And that's why it's too late before. So they're trying to do this to be preventative.
That's not true.
You don't think so?
No. That's baloney. Okay. It's not really baloney, but we'll use the word baloney tonight.
We'll use baloney.
Okay.
Thank you for using baloney.
So, you know, if you go back, you know, they pick on a gun shop or two around here. Those gun shops have never been found to sell a firearm to somebody that wasn't qualified to own one. You go through a federal background check. It's called the National Instant Check System. And then there's the International Justice Information Index, too. Mm-hmm. So they go through all of that. And, you know, it's a thorough check. I know one of the things that's brought up is, well, we got to prevent all this stuff that happened in Aurora.
Right.
Well, what happened in Aurora was awful, and it shouldn't have happened. But as a matter of fact, the state of Mississippi didn't put the data in right. So
the system would have worked.
The system would have worked.
State of Mississippi would have
done. It wasn't an Illinois problem. Right. It was a Mississippi problem.
Let me ask you this, Richard, because I rarely have this conversation on the air because I think it gets very volatile. It becomes partisan. You have one side that is listening right now and texting in furiously, and another side that's texting in, right?
I'll get hate mail in the morning,
of course, right. But let me ask you, just from someone who doesn't have party affiliation, doesn't necessarily subscribe to liberal politics, doesn't subscribe to conservative politics, is recognizing what's happening in this country and sees that there are mass shootings at the clip that we are talking about, and happens seems like every third day in this country. What can be done about this? If the state of Illinois is trying to do it this way and they're strangling small businesses and they're not getting the intended effect that they wanted, from your vantage point at the Illinois State Rifle Association, what can we do?
The first thing you do is when you have a straw purchaser, and Cook County is one of the leading problems in the country, maybe the leading problem, but they never punish them. In 2008, we passed an enhanced Straw Purchase Act. We already had Straw Purchase Acts. Mm-hmm. So when they say that we need this latest deal to prevent straw purchasers, that isn't true. We've done this twice. We enhanced the penalties in 2008. But when you go to the Cook County court system, see how many straw purchasers have actually been prosecuted. Maybe one or two. It's a first charge plea bargained away. It's a reduced sentence. We have a woman, for example, that bought four firearms, sold two to gangbangers, and she got 6 months probation and worked for the county sheriff for 2 weeks. You could get, for four guns, you could get 28 years for that. And she got 6 months probation and worked for the sheriff's department.
So you believe that mandatory minimums and the concept of if you're caught with an illegal firearm, you need to go to jail.
Well, that's true. But the problem with mandatory minimums are they just plea bargain them down anyway. You know, so you say, well, we're enforcing the laws, and so we're going to throw the book at them, and then they're never charged.
Okay, and that's one area, Richard. There's no doubt that the gun problems and gun violence in Chicago is out of control, and someone needs to step up. If not one, all of us need to step up and fix it. The other issue which we see in this country is what happened in California this week, or what happened at Parkland in Florida, or what happened to Sandy Hook. This concept of a lone gunman coming in, being able to purchase a gun, being mentally unstable, and ruining people's lives, taking countless numbers of children and others with them. So what do we do about that when it comes to guns and gun control?
Well, one of the things you have to look at is almost every one of these, including the one in California, was in a gun-free zone. So people who have concealed carry permits can't defend themselves because they can't take a gun into a gun-free zone.
But, this guy, they push back on in California because the police were on that guy in a minute.
California.
Right.
But the guy wanted to do that, so he cut a hole in the fence and passed the gun. Somebody passed the gun to him through the fence. Okay, so it was a gun-free zone. They wanted everybody. Still, somebody got in and do that. When you have people with malice in their heart, they're going to commit mayhem. There's not much you can do about it. But you can defend yourself. For example, in the recent robbery in Virginia Beach, two gunmen came into a convenient food mart, and knowing that 7-Eleven people can't defend themselves, but there was a concealed carry permit holder, and he shot, both gunmen were killed, or shot, not killed. Well, so you have to defend yourself. People say, well, the police will be there. You've got about 15 seconds maximum to defend yourself. The police in California got there in about a minute, which is wonderful, but there are already three dead people.
What do you say to the fact that that's just more guns? You hear this response all the time when you talk about arming teachers, or there's just more guns and more opportunity for things to go awry.
Well, I don't believe that's true. Right now, we have about 500 million guns in the United States. Probably a few get in trouble each year, but they get in trouble every day, but they get in trouble because of people, not because of the firearms. If you look at the FOID card holders in the state of Illinois, look at the crime rate among FOID card holders in Illinois. It is practically zero. You can count them actually by number. You can't statistically measure it because nobody can get the number that small.
Well, Richard, I hope you come back on the show because I am fascinated by this topic, and thank you for coming on and talking about your point of view and the point of view of the Illinois State Rifle Association. Richard Pearson, the executive director of the Illinois State Rifle Association here in the state of Illinois. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Extension 720 rolling along here. Big hour coming up about whistleblowing. Catherine Gunn is going to be here. The whistleblower from the equivalent of the British NSA, who divulged a memo that was sent from the United States government to the British NSA to say, hey, can you get some dirt on the UN Security Council members because we may need to twist some arms to get this vote for this war in Iraq we want to do. It's in the topic of the new film Official Secrets, which is out in theaters soon. Keira Knightley plays Catherine Gunn, but we'll talk with Catherine Gunn tonight. Speaking of guns, good combo. And I appreciate that Mr. Pearson come up. Their office is downstate a little bit, Kankakee County, or maybe it's a little bit further than that. But he comes up and had the conversation, and I appreciate him coming in the studio. It's a conversation we have to continue because we have to figure out how to deal with, like he said, that the people who want to cause mayhem, and if that means changing gun laws at state level, if that means a wholesale change of the way we do things at the federal level, we obviously have to pay attention to the rights of gun owners and the Second Amendment, but we also have to, you know, pay attention to the rights of everybody else that surrounds them. So we're going to have that conversation, continue to have that conversation, and try to keep politics out of it here on Extension 720. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this past week, news broke that former Madigan aide Kevin Quinn is still working in Springfield, getting under-the-table payments for lobbying work as late as January of this year. Quinn was at the center of sexual harassment claims from political consultant Elena Hampton. Hampton accused Quinn of harassment and Speaker of the House Mike Madigan for not doing anything about it. Madigan fired Quinn in early 2018 and also told the press that Hampton was courageous for coming forward. But Hampton also filed a federal lawsuit against Madigan, accusing Madigan's political committee and the Illinois Democratic Party of not doing more to protect her before and after coming forward. Hampton blew the whistle on a culture in Springfield that seems to be rampant, and it started a movement of lawmakers, staff, and advocates to force Springfield to address sexual harassment. A task force was created, new laws were introduced, but this past week's news has many questioning whether all of the response was lip service, and the Boys Network continues to thrive, just not out in the open. For Hampton, this past week's news made her question that as well. She's been pretty silent up to this past week, letting her story do the talking, but she put out a statement, and tonight, Elena Hampton, my guest on Extension 720. Elena, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you put out the statement, and the statement really grabbed my attention because it was really saying that Mr. Quinn can continue to work, but you've had trouble finding any work since the allegations.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, I really was not surprised when I read the story in the Tribune. It wasn't shocking to me, and I honestly don't think it was shocking to anybody. But it was interesting to see it written about, and it was exposed by the Tribune. And, you know, people got to see what exactly I was talking about last year when I was saying that they didn't take the reporting of my situation seriously because I reported it twice. And then, you know, now they're paying him from powerful lobbyists that are close to Speaker Madigan, or, you know, it appears that they are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just felt like a little bit of things that I was saying kind of came true. And, you know, I had proof of it.
Yeah. And part of the statement, too, talked about your troubles of finding work, that there, and this is part of the lawsuit as well, but this idea that there is this retaliation culture in politics, mm-hmm. and that for all the movement that we move forward in Springfield, there's still this don't mess with power kind of vibe coming from that.
Oh, absolutely. It has been tricky since all of the story came forward, but honestly, it was tricky before. And that's the reason I filed the lawsuit in the first place. I mean, I was having issues with work before, so it kind of goes hand in hand. I would say it has gotten worse since the story became public because, you know, people don't reach out to me the same way that they used to about helping them on election campaigns. And I think people are afraid. I've even spoken to a former politician that I've worked with in the past who has said, oh, you know, so-and-so said that, asked me if I was afraid to work with you. And, you know, it's those, like, behind the scenes conversations that go on that nobody knows about.
When you came forward, did you think about what the repercussions would be? Did you think you lived in a society in 2019 where that was a thing of the past?
Oh no, I knew what I was doing. I knew what was going to happen. I fully mentally prepared for it, whatever that means. And I say that because I did mentally prepare for it, but nothing can really prepare you for what happens in a situation like this. But I knew the loss of friendships was coming. I knew the loss of colleagues was coming. And I knew it was going to be like a hush-hush thing. You know, it's difficult to take on someone that's so powerful in these very powerful organizations. And that's why a lot of people aren't willing to do it.
But for everything that you suffer personally and professionally, there has been movement, not standing this past week, but let's talk about, yeah. There has been a sweeping legislation that's been passed. There has been more emphasis put on keeping checks in power and of course, sexual harassment. From your point of view, do you see that Springfield has moved in a different direction?
I would say a little bit, yeah. I think definitely there have been some laws changed that have made big impacts. I think the statute of limitations for sexual harassment doubled in the state of Illinois after my story became public. But you also have to remember that it was 2018 when that story became public. And the fact that that's when we first started looking into it is kind of insane. And when I chose to go public, it's because I knew that if I found out about someone else being harassed and I could have done something to prevent it, it just would have eaten me up inside. And I knew that I had the ability to make a change in that aspect, which is why I spoke out about it in the first place.
We've had these conversations as well about the rampant culture, not just in government or with powerful people, but just in campaigns and elections in general before. And I hope that some of the apparatus has been put into changes, but it was kind of the wild, wild west when it came to HR protections or any sort of harassment, anything like that. It was, you're working for free as, you know, fast and hard as you can, and hopefully you'll get a job at the end, and you pretty much got to put up with everything.
Yeah.
But when you see that that's being addressed, that more and more people are coming forward saying we need to change that culture. Is that something that you look at and say, well, that is a direct result of me telling my story?
I would say yes. I mean, it's clear that many of these changes that were implemented are because the story is very public and people are watching it, right? Do I think enough is being done? Absolutely not. I think people are doing just the bare minimum to make it seem like there's change being affected, but it's really not enough. And it's kind, you know, the story kind of comes in and out of the media, and it's not really until it's picking up in the media again that people remember that it's something that's important to care about.
That's a big point, because there are a lot of times where there's not a campaign going on. Unfortunately, we're getting to a point where there's a campaign all the time, but there are where it's downtime, where we're not talking about these issues. And it feels like this, before this happened, where the Tribune looked into Kevin Quinn's payments, people were not talking about anything that was around sexual harassment or the Me Too movement in Springfield, at least in recent memory.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, it really fell off the radar for the past, at least 6 months. It was this FBI investigation that really brought it up again. And, it's unfortunate that we just kind of like let things fall to the side when it's not picked up in the press every day.
Yeah. Elena Hampton's my guest tonight on Extension 720, talking with her about her story. Of course, we know in Illinois she came forward on sexual harassment allegations against a top Madigan aide. And since then, we have seen movement in Springfield to change what is considered a boys' culture in our state capital. We'll have more conversation coming up here right after the break. Elena Hampton, my guest. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Elena Hampton, my guest in studio tonight here in Extension 720. We're talking about last week the news that came out that Kevin Quinn was still getting paid under the table for some lobbying work. And really, you had a very high profile accusation about sexual harassment with Kevin Quinn, which he was dismissed by Madigan's office. And it really got the ball rolling about Me Too and state government, or not just state government, city, all government and elections and things of that nature. You tweeted out not too long ago about, you said, to the Democratic Women's Caucus, I have now been waiting a full year and a half for you to support me publicly or even address me by name in a statement. Where are you? What is your stance? We all want to know. That's a very powerful statement to the Women's Caucus for the Democratic Party. They're not supporting you?
Publicly, absolutely not. Even behind closed doors, there's very few that have reached out to me. Kelly Cassidy is fantastic all the way around. She's been very supportive. But other than that, it's been almost silent. And I think Carol Ammons made a statement. But other than that, with the women, it's pretty silent. And it's really disappointing. Just 2 weeks before my story broke in February of last year, all of these legislators wore black to the state capitol to raise awareness for victims of sexual harassment and sexual assault. And what's ironic to me is that my story broke 2 weeks later and they didn't even have the audacity to make a statement addressing me by name. And, we have all of these Democratic women who like to say they're so pro-women, they really put themselves out there on the forefront of women, but you have this situation here, a very powerful situation where there's a lot of evidence in what I brought forward, and they're just completely silent about it, and it's obvious because it's something that's impacting their boss. So I certainly find it to be disappointing, but even more than that, the silence when it comes to me is just continuing this culture of sexism, and it's not helping any women feel safe coming forward when they're being abused in the workplace.
Many who might be casual observers of this story say that the government, in particular, the House Speaker Mike Madigan's office has responded. They have gone out of their way to fire the accused, to investigate the claims, to create a task force, and to ultimately get a sexual harassment workplace law passed, sweeping law passed through the House. So the argument might be that there has been movement, that your story has moved it along, and that they have done more for you than maybe that others are seeing.
So I always find this argument interesting because Kevin Quinn was fired exactly 1 year after the first time I reported the sexual harassment. And then additionally to that, he was fired 3 months after Mike Madigan knew about it himself. So that argument isn't really a great one for me. I think people forget about that, those details. Right. So, no, I don't really find that to be a great argument.
When you first brought to the attention of the office that you were being harassed and nothing was done, what happened? Did they give lip service to it? They say, we're going to take care of this. Yep, you know what? Thanks for bringing this to us, Elena. And how did it go down, the first one, a year before we even heard about any of this stuff?
I'm not sure how much I can really speak to this, to be honest, but what I do know is that I was still expected to continue working with him. And by that point, I was so scared. I mean, I was living in fear. And it's never comfortable to be living in fear. And it's not comfortable to work with someone that appears to be obsessed with you. I mean, it wasn't something that had been taking place for a couple of weeks. It was something that had been taking place for 5 months. So that's probably about all I can speak to that.
Elena Hampton, my guest here on Extension 720. You know, there's so much that has been made about you coming forward. And as I've sort of been poking around, the idea of changing the culture in Springfield. But there's also this idea that, you know, oh, well, Mike Madigan didn't really have anything to do with this. That Mike Madigan is he's a head of a large corporation, if you will, which is called the Democratic Party. He can't be aware of everything that his aide is doing. What's your response to that? When it seems that when he has said publicly, when I found out about this, I'm going to do something about it and I'm going to change the way we do things. And you have seen things change. Do you buy that? Do you buy the fact that it's such a huge, sprawling political party that he can't be, he's not the kind of guy that's going to know about everything that's happening everywhere?
No, I don't buy that. I think Madigan chooses to be the boss, and he has firewalls set up with all of his administrative staff that prevent him from finding things out, but that's also a choice that he makes. And if you choose to be the boss, you need to be making sure that all of your employees are being taken care of and not just the top dogs. And additionally to that, especially within my situation, he did know. I mailed a letter to his house, and he knew about it personally for 3 months. So I've said this before. I said in my press conference, I think I really am the first person that ever put it right in front of his face. But I think he should take some fault for the fact that he has set up a system that prevents him from finding out what's really going on in his organizations.
We've seen other people come forward. We've also seen some other top operatives for the Madigan camp to be accused and to resign. How rampant is it from your vantage point, from where you're at and coming forward? Are you coming forward to give voice to many, or is this particularly one story that's coming from you?
I would say for me, this is certainly fighting for justice for myself, but also I knew how big of an impact it would make. And I do believe that it is rampant in Springfield. I think it's out of control all throughout politics in Illinois and probably, you know, around the nation. But specifically speaking to this, I know that even for me, I didn't have anyone to report this harassment to. I reported it to an alderman. That was my only avenue. And unfortunately, that was my harasser's brother, which made it worse. But, you know, when I was working with them, there were never any, like, guidelines of this is where you report something, this is what you do if this situation is happening. It's like, it's almost like living in the 1950s where it just didn't matter at all.
Are you going to get out of politics? I mean, are you thinking, like, I guess it's a two-part question. Why did you get involved in it, and why do you want to stay?
I got involved in politics. I just applied for the Democratic Party right out of college, and I got hired to work with them. That's the extent of that story. I grew up in Central Illinois, so I didn't even really know what the Chicago Machine was, which is kind of funny since I became part of the 13th Ward, right? I'm playing it by ear. I mean, I definitely enjoy what I do. I'm very competitive. I love doing what I do, but it has been very uncomfortable for me the past year and a half. And I definitely would enjoy working in it again. I think it would just have to be the right situation, because when I'm having to deal with the media aspect for myself on top of running a campaign, it does get a little overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I certainly would love to continue working in Chicago politics as long as I'm feeling comfortable with it.
You mentioned the media and all that's come out in a year and a half since you came forward. Do you feel like you have got a fair shake? Do you feel that the media has treated your story in a fair and equitable way?
I do. Yeah, I think they've done a really, really good job of doing the research and, you know, finding out what's factual and what's not factual. I don't have any real complaints about that.
Elena Hampton, my guest tonight in Extension 720. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate you coming on and telling your story.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Responding. Appreciate it. Extension 720 here. 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you until 10 o'clock. Good conversation with Lena Hampton. Coming up, another whistleblower, Catherine Gunn. This movie's really good. It's the movie's called Official Secrets. It's coming out this month, and it stars Keira Knightley. And it's a famous story that she's probably one of the more famed whistleblowers, not named Edward Snowden. She's a British woman who worked in the equivalence of what the NSA is in Britain. She got a memo. This was leading up to the Iraq War, 2002, 2003. She got a memo that the U.S. government wanted the British government to spy on UN Security Council members, dig up any dirt, so that they could use it to twist arms or blackmail those members into voting for a war resolution to effectively legitimize the war in Iraq. She got this memo. She felt it wasn't right. She felt that the politicians that were on the television in front of her were lying. And this is an issue, and she was one of those things where her work got, I mean, she took it to a friend, the friend took it to the paper, and then she came forward. Once everyone started saying, where did this leak come from? Where is this? What is this? And she came forward, and she said, this is me. I did it. But I did it. And it's fascinating how legal, she never actually got prosecuted. They charged her with a treason. And they were going to prosecute her, but her legal team was tremendous in the way that they said, we believe that the war in Iraq is illegitimate, and therefore show us the documents to prove it otherwise. And so they wanted, if they were going to prove or charge her with treason, they needed to prove that that memo wasn't real, or that that memo wasn't the government actually doing illegal acts. And they backed off. The government backed off. The British government's like, oh, okay, sorry. Like, they want to get into it. And to this day, I think there's still questions, alarming questions about whether or not it was legal in the first place, if it was a legitimate war. So we'll talk with Catherine Gunn. We'll be in studio right after this break. And the movie Official Secrets is about her story. Anyway, that's coming up. And then we're going to talk Donny Hathaway and also talk about what to do when you need a new logo. Talk about the power of your logo and the power of branding. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Right now, let's get the headline. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new film Official Secrets stars Keira Knightley and tells the story of Catherine Gunn and her high-profile case during the lead-up to the Iraq War. Gunn worked for the British equivalent of the NSA. She received a memo from the U.S. asking the GCHQ to spy on members of the UN Security Council to gather any information they could to twist their arms into supporting the war. Once the British papers ran the article, Gunn admitted to being the leak and was charged with treason. But the story doesn't end there, because Gunn was never prosecuted, because that would mean the British government would have to give up documents that could prove the illegitimacy of the entire war. It's a fascinating look back at modern history, but also a telling tale about the role of our public servants and what responsibility they may have to expose possible government misdeeds. The great film is based on the real story of Catherine Gunn, and she's my guest in studio tonight. Catherine, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So this film, what do you think? First off, let's get right into it. Keira Knightley plays you. That's a pretty good start.
Yeah, beyond my wildest dreams. Nothing I could have ever imagined.
Really?
Yeah.
The idea of your story being told in this way, you know, when you look back and you see the events unfold on the screen when you watch this film, are they accurate? You know, do you feel like this was the right portrayal of what happened to you?
Yeah, I'm very happy with this production. I think the director, Gavin Hood, when he took over the project, he sat down with me and Martin Bright, who is a journalist, mm-hmm. and Ben Emerson, who is the legal counsel, and everyone involved, basically. But he started off with me, and we spent 5 days pretty much in London, where he said, okay, Catherine, start from the beginning. And so that's what I did, and I just went right through the whole series of events, and he just wrote it all down by hand in this massive leather notebook. And so I've been very much involved, and so has Martin Bright, mm-hmm. and we've all been contributing to it. So I think I stand by it. I think obviously it's a work of, it has a degree of artistic license.
Sure, sure.
And certain characters have been fictionalized, But in the main, you know, there's still people who are alive and well living in the UK and in various parts of the US. And so this is on all the material facts. It's correct.
Yeah. You know, the film, which I really enjoyed, there's a lot of ways you could go with this kind of story. And we see it in Hollywood and all the time. Mm-hmm. The idea that this could be a chase film. This could be an action adventure.
Right.
The premise itself of leaking what could be secrets that could change the course of history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that could go in a lot of different ways. So I guess that's kind of why I ask every time, waiting for some elaborate chase car scene or some Jason Bourne type thing to happen.
Yeah.
But this movie is much, much more about the impact and about the moral implications of speaking out when you feel like your government is doing something wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit to not being a person who's very much into film, but other people have said that this is more akin to things like All the President's Men, and it's a kind of old school,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
More a study in character and just definitely not a high speed Jason Bourne type, you know.
And I like that. Let's get into your story, because mm-hmm. This is the film is based on your story. You are the main character. You were working for, like I said, the equivalent of the NSA for the British government.
Mm-hmm.
A memo comes across that essentially points out what a lot of people in the United States at the time were thinking, that this was really more of a marketing campaign to war than an actual war because of threats or safety.
Right.
And this corroborated or possibly confirmed that.
Mm-hmm.
In your mind at that time in your life, I can't even imagine the idea. There's a great scene where you're moving it from disc to printer and having to deal with the stress that goes around leaking. Take us to that moment in the film where Keira Knightley is making the choice to do this. What was going through your mind at that time?
Yeah, you know, it's 17 years ago, and it feels like a lifetime ago, and it feels like almost like, did it really happen? You know, but I was, as soon as I made the decision that this was something I felt the public should know about, I immediately felt guilty. Like, I immediately knew I was doing something surreptitious and I shouldn't be doing it. It was against all regulations. But at the same time, the memo had appalled me so much. You know, it was the very nature of the language. It was the fact that it was kind of very blasé, mm-hmm. and it wanted, you know, it just expected it. NSA expected GCHQ to do their dirty work. You know, it was as plain as that. So there are still a lot of questions that haven't been answered. So the film is bringing it back up to date, and hopefully journalists will take the bait and ask the questions, especially in the UK, for example, who actually authorized this? Did NSA just simply email this memo over to GCHQ and say, hey guys, do this for us? Mm-hmm. Or did it go through the chain of command, and did the then Foreign Secretary Jack Straw okay it? You know, so
there's a lot of questions.
There are a lot of questions. And I was so appalled by the fact that they were willing to twist arms, that the whole motive was to twist arms, blackmail and bribe and use whatever information they could to get a resolution which would authorize the invasion of Iraq.
Mm.
So once that authorization had taken place, you know, it was like the whole United Nations was saying, okay, we're okay with this.
Yeah, everybody's on board, right?
Everybody's on board to invade a country that was not threatening anybody, you know? And so I guess I was just, it was anger.
And I would assume in the role of being in GCHQ, there are going to be a lot of dirty work. The idea of gathering intelligence or some of the things that you may have to do.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get this. We need to check this person's phone. Whatever it might be. There's a level of, okay, this doesn't really affect me, so I'm going to do it because that's my job.
Mm-hmm.
What about this memo was not just sort of, I'm going to do my job, that I have to speak up?
The red line that I was not prepared to cross was that innocent lives were involved. We're talking about invading a country and dropping countless tons of bombs and missiles on a country, and it would destroy innocent lives, and they had nothing to do with anything, you know. So that was, for me, the red line I was unwilling to cross.
Catherine Gunn is my guest, one of the famed whistleblowers of our modern time, for calling out and really taking a memo that was brought in about the trying to twist arms and blackmail UN Security Council during the lead up to the war in Iraq. The film is called Official Secrets. Keira Knightley's a star. Gavin Hood, the great director, directs it. So we'll continue the conversation. Catherine Gunn in studio tonight here on Extension 720. So stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Catherine Gunn is my guest. Film Official Secrets tells her story. It's a real-life story of the high-profile case of the lead-up to the Iraq War and a leaked memo that really showed the U.S. desire to either, you could say it in a nice way to say twist arms, a bad way to say blackmail, U.N. Security Councils to approve a resolution to go to a war in Iraq. Catherine, this story, you know, is one that, when I say you're of modern history, you're one of the more renowned whistleblowers. This is a story that we have seen in America in the last 10 to 15, 20 years, not just with the Trump administration, but with the Obama administration, mm-hmm. where Edward Snowden and other names that have come forward to essentially say that this is the government is public and we need to know what the government is doing. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of pushback. We even saw where some are don't live in this country are avoiding the government. Mm-hmm. So you see this play out. Your story plays out and plays out and plays out, mm-hmm. and continues. Do you feel like that we've evolved to accept the role or to embrace the role of whistleblower? Or do you feel that the government still controls the narrative and be like that whistleblowers are bad?
You know, that's a very good question. And actually, until this film came out or comes out, I don't think I was that well known. In fact, you know, I would say my case was a footnote in the history of the Iraq War. So, in fact, nobody really knew about my case. However, the issue is very much alive and kicking, as you say. And I think it's probably worse. I mean, because as far as I know, under Obama's administration, he prosecuted supposedly more whistleblowers than any previous presidents combined. Mm-hmm. And that includes people like Thomas Drake, who was very senior NSA managerial position. And he was pushed into his whistleblowing because he'd gone through all the official channels internally and nobody was listening to him. And I think, you know, Ed Snowden and Bradley Manning or Chelsea Manning, they're exposing wrongdoing on the part of the government. So whether you agree or don't agree with their acts, the fact is that in Ed Snowden's case, he was exposing the fact that the U.S. government was wiretapping, was spying on U.S. citizens, and they denied it. They lied about it, you know. And so I think if you find that the government is lying about something which is pertinent to the citizens' well-being and their interest, I won't say it's your duty, but I think you have to be very conscious of your decision whether to go along with it or to expose it.
In your case, you know, you talked about a little bit about the feeling of when you actually did it. When you were seeing the fallout, mm-hmm. even before you came forward, was it more heightened? Did you feel the weight of the world on your shoulders as more and more? There's a great scene where Keira Knightley didn't think that they thought they'd investigated, perhaps not just leaked the memo on the front page of the papers, but there seemed to be this such an overwhelming story about not trusting the governments when it came to trying to get this war in Iraq off the ground. Mm-hmm. Did you feel the weight of the world on your shoulders as the story was out and no one knew you were behind it?
No, my biggest fear at the time was becoming known. So when the story was splashed across the front pages of the Observer newspaper, that moment when I saw that, I was absolutely terrified. I was literally sick with terror, you know, and part of it was that the realization that I wasn't going to get away with it. You know, I knew then that I wasn't going to be able to claim innocence over this. Mm-hmm. And for my own conscience as well. I mean, I've never been any good at telling lies. So I couldn't carry on a kind of duplicitous role at GCHQ pretending I had nothing to do with it. But yeah, really my biggest fear was not being anonymous anymore. So that, I just had a real fear of losing the anonymity thing of just being an everyday, ordinary citizen.
When you came forward and you took credit for this, that's another part of this film that's very interesting, because automatically, and I don't know if this is the American in me, that this would be a film about how the government treated you once you were in there. But there was just more of a, it felt, at least in the movie, it felt that there was this, it was very up and up, meaning they were like, we're going to charge you. This is how it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Were you afraid of what could happen to you while in custody to the British government when they're thinking about what to do with you?
Well, you know, the whole process took a year. So I was actually bailed for 8 months. And when I was arrested on suspicion of breaking the Official Secrets Act, I was kept overnight for just under 24 hours in the police cells. But then I was bailed, and I was bailed for 8 months. And it was just this constant kind of limbo of not knowing what was going to happen to me. And meanwhile, having been told that I wasn't able to actually discuss my case with my lawyers.
Yeah.
You know, so the gagging thing.
Right.
So
if you did, then you were guilty.
Yeah, right. And that was very frustrating, and I felt very alone throughout the whole process. And it was only when I was charged in November 2003 that my name came out. And at that point, I suddenly got overwhelming support, especially from the US. So that was when Dan Ellsberg personally got in touch with me, bless his heart, and all these other, you know, they signed, and Democracy Now! And Accuracy.org and IPA, you know, they got people motivated to support me. They sent out press releases.
Did you think that would happen? Do you think that?
No, I had no idea. Yeah. And I got hundreds of emails from US citizens who sent these just really supportive, heartfelt emails about, you know, how they were so proud of me and stuff like this. And it was amazing. You know, I was really, really touched by that.
Obviously, it was a big anti-war movement at the time, and there continues to be. But this was one that, you think about the large, I think the largest in history, the demonstrations against the war.
Mm-hmm.
There was a movement, and in a way, it seemed to cloud. I don't want to say the objective necessarily, mm-hmm. but it clouded because there was so much in the anti-war movement that everyone thought maybe this memo was a fake or this was being planted by the anti-war activists of the time.
Yeah,
that this was not a real story. That it almost mirrors what's happening in 2019, where everything is partisan. But this idea that that's fake and that's not real. How does that make you feel when you think about the idea of doing this to speak out and for people to put you in a corner or to say that this is what you are and your motives are not clear?
That's kind of why I've not thrown myself forward to be a mascot or to be. I mean, back in 2004. You know, I was just newly married. In fact, when this whole thing kicked off, when I leaked the memo, my husband and I had only been married 6 months. So I just wanted to have this normal family life. And I was very wary of jumping onto a bandwagon and being manipulated into something that I wasn't. Because I also was quite cognizant of the fact that I wasn't very knowledgeable, and I was still pretty naive, I think, in some respects. So, yeah. So for me, once the story had blown over, all I wanted to do was to go back to normality, live my life, and, you know, and that's pretty much what I've done. In the main.
This film, obviously very specific about a moment in time in which I think is still playing out. I don't think that the verdict is in yet about what led up to the war and whether or not these are war crimes by people who had different motives than protecting their people. But I come back to the idea of the whistleblower, because we've seen, and there's some great stuff in the film too, discussing this stuff. But this notion that we see in the Trump administration in America of more embarrassing the president, president said this behind closed doors, or the president leaked it, or someone leaked this about what the president might have done or said in a closed door meeting. I think it confuses a little bit this idea of what, you know, you're doing to make sure that the government is not doing wrong,
mm-hmm.
and what you're doing to politically embarrass maybe your competitor or different party, or maybe someone you don't want to be running your party.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you see it that way? That I think that's where it gets clouded about people's thoughts on leaks and whistleblowers.
No, I would agree with that. And I think there's always been situations where, you know, there are internal leaks. I mean, we know that within the government, there are people who have links with media organizations. And we know that they will feed stories to the media organization just to kind of make some other person look bad or to sabotage their campaign or whatever.
Political advantage.
Yeah, it's all right. So that's totally different to people, ordinary citizens like myself who are working a job, whatever the job is, whether you're working in intelligence or in any other sphere, you see wrongdoing on the part of your government or your organization or your industry. If you try to bring those issues up internally and you get stonewalled or you get bullied or you get pushed out of your job, then something is wrong, you know, because whistleblowers are crucial in preventing sometimes catastrophic things, you know, and for example, in the nuclear industry or in submarines or, you know, there's any manner of things that you would like to know if something is not right.
Catherine Gunn, my guest. The film is Official Secrets. Gavin Hood, the director, Keira Knightley. That's one of the best actresses of our time, and she gets to play you on screen. Catherine Gunn, thank you so much for being my guest and talking about the film and your life here on Extension 720.
Thank you very much.
That'll wrap up our whistleblower hour here on 720 WGN. This is interesting text of people coming in. 630, we got someone from 815. Both essentially saying that we should stop making heroes out of the whistleblowers. But, I don't know, listening to her story, I think it's, what would you do if you're in a situation where you actually had information that proved that a country's government was lying? What would you do with it? That's an interesting question. And the basis for that movie, Official Secrets, which is pretty good. Keira Knightley plays Catherine Gunn in that film. All right, coming up, we make a nice transition from whistleblowers to soul music, and one of the more underappreciated soul singers of all time, Donny Hathaway, will be honored at Millennium Park coming up on Monday. Mario Smith is in the studio. He will be talking about that. He put it together.
Love, love, love. Why'd you take so long to come to me? Oh, baby. To find someone to take your place, it was all in vain. No, their lips were never quite.
Extension 720 here on 720 WGN, the music of Donny Hathaway, who will be honored and celebrated. His music on stage at the Millennium Park at Pritzker Pavilion coming up on Monday. A very underappreciated soul singer who was born here in Chicago, who lived a very short life. He died at the age of 33, died in 1979. But Donny Hathaway, when you look at his music and the music that people obviously remember, that song and even Christmas songs, and it's Pete's favorite Christmas song. You get this feeling that Donny Hathaway played a bigger part in our lives than people remember, and that's what's trying to be done at Millennium Park coming up here on Monday. The host will be Mario Smith. Mario, longtime regular contributor to
Justin.
Anything that I ever am involved in. Great to see you, buddy.
Man, it's good to be seen. It's nice to be up here in the Skyline studio. Pete Zimmerman knocking it out with the hits.
That's right.
He almost, only thing he didn't do was hit the post. That's that man.
So Donny Hathaway, this is a big thing for you. You're hosting, you're executive producer on this.
Yeah.
Oh, where did this idea come from?
Well, first, thank you for having me. I co-curated an event with Gil Complex 8 years ago. We did a similar thing, a tribute to Gil Scott-Heron. Mm-hmm. And that night on the stage, I was like, you know, we should do one for Donny Hathaway. And I just said it. I was thinking it all the time that we were putting that together. Like, I'm thinking of another artist while we're putting together the Donny Hathaway thing. And it was like, okay, then do it. And I had the cachet at the time, and it was like, well, do it. So I started talking to Tracy Matthews from the Center for Black Studies. I can't remember the whole name now, at the University of Chicago. And she was like, well, how do you plan on doing this? How do you propose doing this? You know, this costs money, blah, blah, blah. She just gave me a whole list of stuff that I knew I couldn't do. And so I started talking to Corey Wilkes, who is also an executive producer. And he's like, we can do it, but we have to have, you know, this has to make sense to mm-hmm. do. Things changed in my life. Started working for the Promontory. Started really paying attention to how the events were being put together. And went back into my relationship with the Gil Complex a little bit. And then I just said, you know what, man? I'm doing it. I've got the people I know. I've made enough contacts with people who can actually facilitate the things I want done. In my head, I wanted to do it at the Lyric Opera or at Symphony Center. And the idea was to bring people to the city from outside of the regular city mm-hmm. confines to celebrate this man's music. And I had called David Chavez on the phone one day from the Department of Cultural Affairs. And I was like, can I meet with you? I just want to talk to you about something. Just kind of see what you think. And then he goes, we can do it in Millennium Park. I had never thought about that. That was not...
I mean, it's a great fit to do it in a beautiful
in the
night.
Backyard.
In the obviously, in the Pritzker Pavilion.
Yeah. Well,
why Donny Hathaway? For Chicagoans. Born here, he obviously, his career, he had a lot of success here working with Curtis Mayfield mm-hmm. and others. But he's also well known for being... And he grew up in St. Louis. He also made his name in New York City. Mm-hmm. So why Donny Hathaway? Why Chicago?
Well... I've always felt like he was underappreciated in Chicago. And it seemed to me, when you got a singer, a musician, a composer of his magnitude, in a city like this that has, I mean, it curates great, I hate that word, it brings out the best of artists. So you've got every genre of music has these iconic Chicago artists. And I'm like, how come they don't give Donny Hathaway his props? What is it? Why is it because of the way his passing happened? Is it because we don't really have enough information about his Chicago connections? And then I just said, you know what, man? This music is too good, and it's too rich, and it really speaks to the Chicago sound that he helped cultivate to not have him be honored properly. And I was a little angry that the city had not taken the initiative years ago to honor
him. That is interesting, because you think of some of the other soul singers in Chicago, and I think of Curtis Mayfield, mm-hmm. of course, the Impressions, Jerry Butler. Mm-hmm. And down the line, I mean, people know this town to be a soul music town.
Exactly.
The origins are so deep. And you're right, to think that Donny Hathaway doesn't fit into that seems to be a mistake.
It was almost like he was being left out and not being talked about in that light. And it's hard to imagine American soul music without Donny Hathaway's contribution in it. It's really hard to imagine Rock Steady by Aretha Franklin without that Hammond in it. That's Donny Hathaway playing that. It's Bernard Purdy playing the drums. They went uncredited on Rock Steady. There's a bunch of like information I found out along the way, thanks to people like mm-hmm. Dwayne Powell and Ion Contreras, who also helped me put this all together.
There's so much about his career, because you're going to know him as a soul singer. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I mean, songs like Ghetto. What else has he done? He did Back Together Again with Roberta Flack.
Yeah.
But there is a lot behind the scenes of whether he's producing or he's writing, because he wrote for Curtis Mayfield. And he wrote, like you just said, mm-hmm. like he's playing on Rock Steady, that people just don't even recognize other contributions to really great, iconic American music.
And with that being said, this is why this is happening on Monday. It's the culmination of all of that stuff, and really getting into the whole why him, because this music is important. It's relevant, more relevant than it probably has ever been. And it's Donny Hathaway, right? It's like it's the familiarity for people here in town. They know when I mentioned it tonight in the lift, my man Shelby. Thank you, Shelby, for getting us here.
Safely. Shelby getting the shout out.
He's probably in his car like, I don't believe it. That's really him. when you say, hey, what are you doing Monday? And like, I'm not doing anything. Come to Millennium Park 6:30. We're doing a tribute to Donny Hathaway. Oh, Donny Hathaway.
I'm listening, right?
That's when I knew. When I started talking about this to people, I knew when I said his name and people's reaction was visceral and emotional, I was like, this is the only thing I can do. I know we can work if we plan it properly.
The event is called Love, 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 Celebrating the Music of Donny Hathaway. It's at Millennium Park on Monday, August 5th at 6:30. It's free.
It'll
be hosted by Mario Smith, and also there'll be music, live music, all the people that you were just talking about involved in contribution.
Here's the thing, man. The lineup, right, for the event is the thing. So it's Micaiah McRaven, Junius Paul, Charles Heath, Corey Wilkes, of course, Rajiv Halim, Cahill Elzebar. It's
a lot of great
crazy
jazz names. Yeah,
we got a brother that played with Donny Hathaway playing. I mean, Ugochi, Tina M. Howe, Marquell Jordan, Renee Ruffin, Merrill, Yao, Megan McNeil, Frank McComb, Cy Smith. It's big. Miguel de la Serna is helping us with strings. This is big. My vision was to create a moment that people will remember all year long. Whatever's left of this year, this will be the thing that will be like, man, you didn't come, you missed it.
Go big or go home, right?
That's me. You know me. I'm a Sox fan. I'm go big or go home on everything.
I love, love, love celebrating the music of Donny Hathaway. Going to be at Millennium Park at the Pritzker Pavilion coming up on Monday. We'll take a break. Come back. More with Mario Smith in studio here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Love, Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Love, 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 celebrating the music of Donny Hathaway. This Monday, August 5th at Pritzker Pavilion at Millennium Park, free show. All great Chicago musicians coming together to pay tribute to Donny Hathaway. Even listening to this music as we listen right here in the inn, his relationship with Roberta Flack.
Yeah.
All those are hits. All those were chart toppers at the time. And it's interesting, too, because it's a kind of music that the duet, the sort of R&B or the soul music duet, that kind of went away. This idea that the two musicians come together. But yeah, his relationship with Roberta Flack, reading about it, they went to college together.
Went to Howard.
Yeah, they went to Howard. Yeah. They knew each other, but just a tremendous creative experience, the two of them together. And it continued even after he died.
Well, Back Together Again came out after he died.
And that's unbelievable.
And that was one of the strongest duets in the history of soul music. And I think had he hung around, I think that they may have really, they would have been Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. Mm. It would have been that kind of a thing. But, you know, listening to his music, even in the with Corey compiling the songs, which meant listening, really listening to it, he was a master at telling a story. There's a lot of heartbreak and a lot of just like romantic, he romanticizes heartbreak in such a way where you feel where he's coming from. You know it. There's a song called Memories of Our Love that did not get released that I shouldn't tell the list, but it's on the list. And Memories of Our Love, it's real subtle and it's unfinished, which is why it wasn't released. But you can see where he was going. He's really talking to this woman about the fact that he realizes that she's on to the next, right? But the love he has for her and the love that she has for him, it's still there. He was a master at writing that. He's amazing.
When we talked about being a Chicago musician, Donny Hathaway has, because he had spent time in different cities, doesn't necessarily get the love in Chicago. But I think about hearing that song and listening to Donny Hathaway music today. You can hear the influences from Curtis Mayfield. You can hear the Chicago of working at Curtis Records. There's a sound that came out of Chicago at that time, and it feels like he fits into it, even if you didn't know he was from here. That's the sound.
And that's what I mean. The Chicago sound in the 70s and in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, cultivated by like Carl Davis and Curtis Mayfield and all these great musicians and singers and stuff, and endorsed and embraced by your Aretha Franklins and your Stevie Wonders and all that. It was a real thing. That Chicago sound was real. No happy flutes. Real soulful, real guttural. You know what I mean?
It was no real. Happy flutes.
Well, Motown was known for the happy flute.
Yeah, right.
In their songs. That's what they called it, the happy flute.
The happy flute.
And the Chicago sound was, it was 63rd and Cottage Grove, man. It was K-Town. It was, you know, when you heard it, you're like, oh, I know where they're from.
Right.
And it kind of kept going, even with rap music. When you hear Kool Out Chris or a Rashid Hadi track, or something that No ID did, that it's the embodiment it's of the Chicago vibe, sound. Right. It has that element in it. You can't escape it when you hear it.
You know, I don't think that soul music, and Marvin Gaye sort of embodies this, and I think that Marvin Gaye becomes the national emblem for this, but this idea that soul music in the 70s was telling the story of Black America.
Oh, absolutely.
And in a way that, you know, you could see stories of what's happening in neighborhoods, or you can see stories of even political themes that came out. Well, how much of that was being played out in Chicago? When you think about the Chicago soul sound, they were telling the story of, like you said, 63rd and Cottage Grove, but how much did it, you know, because you have the Marvin Gaye experience where he was able to tell all of America the plight of what was happening with Black America. How much of Chicago embodied that? Were they doing the same thing?
Oh, the Staple Singers.
Mm-hmm.
The Staple Singers were the grand marshal of it. You know, Curtis Mayfield. Keep going back to Curtis, which is funny because years ago we did a tribute to Curtis Mayfield at the MCA. When you talk about Chicago music and you talk about the Civil Rights Movement, or you talk about just protest music in general, there's a lot of Chicago in that. Again, the Staple Singers ushered in it was cool to do that if you were young. It was cool. You didn't have to just necessarily, you know, be Marvin Gaye, but you could be cool. You could be a cool Black woman and tell this story and have your dad play this guitar over this really powerful message. But there would be people who say that rap music tells the story of Black America too. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of American, but it's a story nonetheless. The parts that are intelligible as I stare at you.
But there's something to be said, though, because Chicago gets you know, when you think about what's that Chicago sound when it comes to hip-hop, you will get a Kanye West, a Common, even Chance the Rapper to an extent, that kind of backpack rap kind of vibe.
Makes sense.
A conscious rap.
Yeah.
Was that the same in the 70s soul? When you're thinking of 70s soul, were they doing that kind of thing soul music in the 70s?
Well, remember now, I hope I don't upset anybody in Bannockburn, but Black people weren't getting treated very well and still aren't getting treated very well. Mm. So the idea that music was used to speak to our plight never stopped. It's Public Enemy. It's KRS-One. It's the Wu-Tang.
Donny Hathaway.
There you go.
Right.
It's our issues are American issues. They just like to put a color on them to go, that has nothing to do with me because I'm not Black. That's their thing. If you can't buy groceries at a grocery store near your house, if you are debating on whether to feed your family or keep your lights on, that's an American problem. It's not just isolated to be a Black problem. And these musicians in the 70s and until now, well, not so much now, but the plight of the people who live in this country, if it's not going to be spoken to by the musician, nobody's going to say.
I wonder if part of Donny Hathaway's legacy was clouded by his mental illness, because he was diagnosed as schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to have played some role. It's a little murky on how he died.
Mm-hmm.
He suicide jumping out of a New York hotel room, which is still questionable. Some, you know, you know the story, but there seemed to be, I don't know if people didn't, I don't want to say they turned their back on the story, but because he had that mental illness, because of the way that he died, do people just kind of want to sweep that in under the rug and put it in the closet and think of some other musicians?
Well, I mean, look at how we deal with people who have, look at how we deal with mental illness in 2019 as opposed to 1973. That's like, oh, that guy's crazy. That lady's crazy. They were crazy. There was nobody saying, I think if we can reach what's in them that's making them a little unbalanced or off, that we might be able to bring them to the part where they can deal with their mental illness. We look at mental illness now as we should do everything we can to help somebody that has a mental illness issue. I think with Donny Hathaway, because that was not something that people talked about, they tended to just kind of be like, yeah, let's concentrate on his music and not so much on what was wrong with him.
Right.
One of the things that I wanted to do with this event that I plan on doing is extending that conversation about mental illness amongst people, not just black people or Latinos or Asians or white people, just amongst people. Because if we don't really start dealing with the why this is happening to people and how to treat it and help people, you know, there's a lot more good you can do by exposing the dialogue and making that a thing as opposed to not talking at all.
Always great to have you up here, man.
Thank didn't you know all this
and
stuff,
you
did you?
And you didn't have to cross the bridge.
You know
what? Because
when
we were over at the Trib Tower, you had to cross that bridge.
The Harms family from Houston, Texas helped me across
the
bridge.
That's right.
I talk to them every now and then on Twitter.
Where can we find you? I know news from the service entrance is lumping now.
You're 18.
Yeah.
My show is old enough to vote.
It's a great show.
Thank you.
And you can hear Thursdays. It's still Thursdays?
Thursdays at 2 p.m. Okay. Rebroadcast on Tuesday mornings at 10. I'm getting like you now.
There you go. And where can we find you on social media?
Mario in Hyde Park on Instagram and on Twitter. And come see me at the Promontory.
Okay, so the show is Love, 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 Celebrating the Music of Donny Hathaway. It is going to be at Millennium Park coming up on Monday, August 5th.
They let me on the stage.
They let you on that big stage.
They messed up.
They messed up. 6:30, it's a free show. Chicago coming together to celebrate the genius that was Donny Hathaway.
Absolutely.
Mario, great to see you, buddy.
Always good seeing you, man. Thanks.
Yeah, you got to go out and see the great show that's coming up, Donny Hathaway show coming up at Millennium Park on Monday. More to come. We got to talk a business story about, let's say you have a logo and you've had this logo in your small business. You're excited about it. But over time, you don't like the colors. You don't like the way it kind of plays out. Maybe the fonts have changed. The story we're talking about next in Downloading Chicago Business is really about what to do when it's time to change your logo and to really take a closer look at how brand trends are changing in 2019. We'll have that conversation coming up right after the news. It's time for the Downloading Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is our segment that talks to business entrepreneurs in Chicago, get their stories so we can better understand ours. Ross Kimborowski is the founder and CEO at CrowdSpring. CrowdSpring is doing what you would think is the number one thing that you would think about with a small business, is creating a brand and a logo. The things that you just kind of don't think about when you're starting a business, but they're very, very important. Ross is here. Ross, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here. It's one of the things that for many businesses is an afterthought, but is one of the most important differentiators in the market today, because to build a strong brand identity, and a brand identity is everything visual about a brand, used to be nice, but not critical. Today, right. Business is international. You have more competition. You're going to find customers all over the place. And so you must have a strong brand identity to compete. And successful business owners learn this. Ones who are starting out need to know it from the beginning.
I feel like let's go through the evolution of it, because you're right. At a certain point, it felt like it was necessary, but not critical, and to have a great brand or a great logo. And that has changed over time to the point now where there are boutique advertisers and design firms that this is what they do. They make logos.
They do. And so part of the challenge for small businesses in particular is building a brand identity could be very expensive. So agencies traditionally would charge tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Small businesses don't have those kinds of budgets. Unfortunately, we're still competing with other companies that do. And so to become competitive, you have to find alternatives. It's one reason we launched CrowdSpring 11 years ago. We wanted to deliver brand identity, so logo designed for $300, not $30,000. And also flip the model. So instead of creating a request for proposals on CrowdSpring, you actually explain what you need, and dozens of designers compete to create a design. You pick your favorite. So it's the way we shop for televisions, the way we buy clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Much easier way for business owners, much more affordable for business owners, and you're still working with experienced designers.
It's amazing to me, because we do a ton of disruptor conversations on the Download in Chicago Business, and we talk about how one entrepreneur is disrupting the flower business or coffee business or manufacturing, whatever it might be. But in this case, you are a disruptor, because you're disrupting the design field, where there has been this is how you do it, And you're looking to change that.
So we're in an interesting position because in one sense, we are disrupting the design industry, but we're not really directly disrupting it. That industry has been hurting for a long time. Part of the challenge is that clients don't have the big budgets they used to have before. And so agencies are hurting. They don't have the ability to hire as many people as they used to. Clients are restricting budgets, so they're spending less. And so in essence, while we're offering an alternative to our small business clients, we're also offering a great amount of leverage for agencies. So smaller agencies who don't have the ability to hire designers are leveraging CrowdSpring to provide that work on behalf of their own clients. So right. If you're a solo marketer and you have a couple clients, here's a chance for you to triple, quadruple your book of business using CrowdSpring as a backstop. Our creatives do all the design work, you do the strategy. So it solves both parts of the problem. And while it does disrupt in some ways the way design has been done, that evolution started before we came the scene.
I guess we can talk specifically and generically about design and your logo. When you start to talk to small businesses, and in CrowdSpring, there'll be several designers that come to, you know, that give their input. But what is the most important thing that you look for in a logo?
So if you think about the essence of what logo is, brand identity is everything visual about your brand. So it starts with your name, your logo, it's your website. But when it comes to a logo, you have really four factors that you need to focus on. The first is it has to embody your brand. So if it's just a random symbol that isn't connected to who you are, it's not going to help you. Now, it does take time. So the Nike logo doesn't embody the Nike brand on day one. It takes time of usage and storytelling. Number two, it has to be instantly recognizable. So if it's overly complicated, if it doesn't allow a prospective customer to immediately tell that that's your logo, it's really hard. Number three, it has to be versatile. It has to be small. So if you put it on a business card, it makes sense. But you also need to be able to put it on a big billboard if that's what your business needs to do. And if you can't do that with your logo, then it's not a good one. And finally, it should be timeless because you are building a brand identity, meaning you want people year after year to recognize. So if you're changing your logo every single time, people will be confused. Everything else is optional. So it doesn't have to follow fads or trends. It just has to meet those four things. And business owners need to understand that what may look good to them doesn't translate to what actually looks good in the market.
When is it time for you to change your logo? And that, you know, if you are some listening to you, you got to be buyer beware in the sense that you don't want to change it too many times because of customer loyalty and how people recognize you. But what do you say to clients to say it's time to change logo?
There are a number of different factors. First of all, there may be aesthetic factors. If you got a template when you started your business and your logo looks like hundreds or thousands of other logos, it's not helping you create a unique brand identity. That's a sure sign time that you should change it and find something custom. You know, CrowdSpring can certainly help with that. There are other places. Sometimes companies will change a logo because there's something going on that's impacting the company. One good example is Uber last year changed their logo and improved it in a number of ways because they had received a lot of negative press attention and attention from the public, and they were trying to shift their brand to show that they were changing as a brand. And one way to show change as a brand is to change your brand identity. So they changed their logo. Other companies do it all the time. Pizza Hut just did it, going back from a fairly modern-looking logo to a retro logo, the one they used 50 years ago. So it's a good way to signal to the market either a change in your business. So if you've been a very small company trying to become global or national, or a step in a different direction. If you face some hardships and now you want to show that you're making a change and you're doing something better.
I think about it from the business owner's side about what to watch out for when you want to change your logos, but from a designer's standpoint, from the people who are making the logo, where do they go wrong? Where does it go wrong in the design standpoint of a logo?
So part of the challenge is experience and training, and some of it has to do with the communication between the designer and the client. It's actually what caused me to start CrowdSpring in the first place 10 years ago. I was an attorney. We hired a firm to redesign our website, and I didn't know how to communicate with the design firm, and I hated the work they did. And that's what got me to start thinking, isn't there a better way to buy design services? Why do I have to explain to them what I want and then wait for 2 months for them to create it? Why can't I just tell them what I want and then pick from among a lot of different choices? So part of the challenge is communication. This is something we spend a lot of time at CrowdSpring working with both clients, educating them, and our designers. So our designers, we have 220,000 from all over the world. In a typical project, you'll have several dozen participating. And so we spend a lot of time talking to them about ways that they need to present designs to clients. So clients will often look at just aesthetics. They'll focus on things like colors, which are very easy to change, as opposed to the important elements, which is readability, clarity, whether you can size it easily. Is it overly complex to the point where it's just hard for a person from an initial view to see it? I'll give you a good example. The original Apple logo was very complicated. It was Isaac Newton, Apple falling from a tree. Very hard to tell what it was. And after a year, it was used for a year, Steve Jobs realized that it really didn't reflect their brand. People couldn't readily recognize that the brand was supposed to be new and interesting, and they designed something very different. And so every business owner should ask themselves the same question. Is my logo unique enough? Does it stand out in the marketplace? And if the answer to those questions is no, that's a good time to start creating a strong brand, because it is very expensive to take an existing brand and rebrand it. Big companies can spend hundreds of millions of dollars easily rebranding everything. Smaller companies could easily spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so getting it right in the beginning, very important.
Ross, how important is it? Or I should say, if I'm running my own business, I'm listening to this, and I haven't put money into my brand identity, what's the percentage? I'll have business owners who say, listen, I make widgets. That's what I do. I make widgets. You know, like, it's what I do. I don't need to have a fancy logo telling people about my widgets. How much should they be thinking about brand identity from a monetary standpoint when it comes to expenses?
So this is where you have lots of choice. I mean, one of the reasons we built CrowdSpring was to give people that option. If their budget was under $1,000, CrowdSpring is a great place to get that logo. If your budget is $5, $10, there are template sites that let you get a template logo. The risk is your business looks like 1,000 other businesses. So your widgets look like everybody else's widgets. You can't stand out. So generally, we recommend that businesses budget between $500 and $1,000 for that initial brand identity, the logo design, and associated elements. And then obviously, a brand identity is more than just a logo. And this is one of the common misconceptions a lot of business owners make. You hire a designer to design your overall brand identity, not to just design your logo. And that has to do with colors and how you visually communicate. So WGN has a brand identity. It's not just the name. It's not just how the logo looks, but how the website looks, the colors, the consistency in which those colors are used, on the radio, how things are presented. And that's true for every single business. So it's really important for a business as it continues to grow to maintain that consistent brand identity. The successful businesses, if you look at whether it's technology companies or retail businesses like Walmart, Amazon, they've all developed a very consistent brand identity that has created a lot of loyalty in the marketplace. Part of it is because people know what to expect. So if we back up for a moment and ask, what is it about a logo that's interesting? And there are really two things. When we see a logo, there's a chemical reaction in our bodies that creates an expectation of what a product or service from a company will be like. So if you love Apple products and you see an Apple logo with a box and you don't even know what the product is, you're going to get excited because you think that product is going to be good. And the second is the expectation of how it'll work. It's memorable. It'll work great. If you hate that particular brand, then you're not going to care what's in the box. And that's what every business wants to create, is that excitement around your logo. This is why kids advertising focuses on brands, and you have those logos constantly put in front of them. Because when kids see a logo of their favorite toy company, they want those toys. When they see a McDonald's, they scream, you know, I want to go to McDonald's. And so at the end of the day, it's around making sure that your brand identity creates an impression in your customers and prospects.
Ross, my final question to you, just, you know, this is a worldwide company, CrowdSpring, but it's here in Chicago. What is it about Chicago that makes CrowdSpring work?
You know, we started working on the business back in 2006, when the technology community was a little chaotic in Chicago. There were lots of good, successful businesses, but there wasn't the kind of support network that exists today. And we loved working here. People were very helpful. When we were starting out, we had a lot of questions. We didn't know how to hire. We didn't know whether to outsource product development work. And so people were very helpful. And over the years, this incredible community has grown up here with tons of entrepreneurs and support networks and places where you can learn. And so we want to continue supporting that. We have a distributed team. So we have a few people in Chicago, but we have people in other countries in the world. And we have designers in 195 countries and clients in 100 countries. So we can be anywhere. I could be sitting on an island running the business, but we love Chicago. This is where we started. I actually emigrated from the former Soviet Union in the late 1970s and came directly to Chicago. So it's my home.
There you go. Ross Kimborowski is the founder and CEO of CrowdSpring, talking about the importance of brand identity and logos. Ross, thanks for being our guest tonight. I appreciate
Thanks so much.
That's going to do it for Extension 720 tonight. Programming note, we're back next week. We have three shows in a row. We don't usually get this. I think it's a combination of some day games and some off days for the White Sox. But next Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we'll have full shows here on Extension 720. We'll have some fun with that. Put together some good stuff. In the meantime, we'll go out and canvas this city for stories. Like the gumshoe producers and hosts that we are. Possible. Or just go to Lollapalooza, one of the two. I'm not going to Lollapalooza this year. Are you going, Pete? Is that on your...
I am not.
No?
No.
I figured you'd be one of the fence jumpers.
In my old days, I had a bad hip.
I saw someone tweeted out that the police scanner had somebody jumped a fence and impaled themselves, like a leg or something like that. I wouldn't make fun of it if they were dead, but I think it's...
It was fun seeing them. It's fun seeing those fence jumpers in action.
Yeah.
I saw a couple at Pitchfork, and it's just fun to see them kind of like, they look, you know, you're on the other side, you kind of see their head pop up from the other side.
I know,
and they
right?
kind of look around, they jump, and then they dart as fast as they can into the middle of the mix so like nobody can find them. Wow. It's really funny.
Well, you know, I was thinking about it because when you're on Lakeshore Drive, I was on Lakeshore Drive, they triple fence Lakeshore Drive.
Oh.
So you're jumping over a couple fences now. If you're trying to go, I don't know if
it's like an Olympic event.
Yeah, exactly. If you're trying to find a certain spot, maybe there's like a place in Lollapalooza where it's just there's just one fence, maybe two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if you're looking at Lakeshore Drive, trying to jump from that side, they've got three different fences. Jerry, you a fence jumper?
No, I'm not. That would break my back. I did hear about special fences they have if there's an emergency, evacuation or something, that they push out. They just don't push in.
Oh, there you go.
I thought that was really interesting.
That's good, interesting technology.
Yeah.
I talked about this on the Lower Wacker Live podcast today, the idea that I would like an expose. I'd like to know more about Lollapalooza Jail.
Okay.
Are you familiar with this concept? There's a Lollapalooza jail.
Especially for people that are taken out.
Yep, for anyone who breaks the law in any form inside of Lollapalooza, they have a space that is Lollapalooza jail. And I believe it's run by the Chicago police, and it's a quick, like, you know, we're going to do immediate booking.
Okay.
Like, they're not, and they have a jail there and the whole bit. I'd love to know more about that story. Cause all I ever get from Lollapalooza stories is it's so hot out here. It's so not hot. It's wet. The bands are loud and there's some cool stuff to get for free. Like, I feel like I want to know about Lollapalooza jail and I want to know more about the community that gathers around Lollapalooza. Especially at night. Like, I've gone a couple times, and I remember, like, around 5 or 6 o'clock, and the people who are around, you get a lot of hawkers. Like, a lot of people who are trying to sell you the onion or trying to get you to do, or I need tickets, you got tickets.
Yeah.
There's so much going on Michigan Avenue in front of Lollapalooza that I think would make for a great story about who those people are and obviously what Lollapalooza attracts to downtown Chicago with all these people coming downtown.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good time for them to make money off the tourists.
Yeah.
People are from all over the world coming for this. So
it gets super seedy. I'm not going to lie to you. Like, when where that entrance is at by when you're at Jackson and Michigan Avenue, you go in there. I just remember being like, well, this is not lunch hour. Right. This is not Michigan and Adams at lunch.
Yeah.
It's not by the Panera. Where's the Panera bread? I feel like I'm missing. But so yeah. I would like a story on that. But that's, you know,
that's good. I mean, I want to get in the jail, break into the jail myself.
You could do an expose.
Yeah. Jerry Nunn, on the wall.
Jerry Nunn is coming up at 10 o'clock here. He's going to take you through to 1 o'clock this morning here on 720 WGN. Just the voice that came out of nowhere.
Yes.
But are you going to Lollapalooza?
I was there all day.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
All right. Our Lollapalooza report.
I seriously just ran in from something.
What makes you go to this? What is it about Lollapalooza?
I've been covering this thing. Well, I went to the first Lollapalooza back in 1991.
That's great.
I was at the very first one.
Where'd you see it?
It was in Cleveland. You know, it was back when it was a touring show. And it was, you know, James Addiction. Yeah. Back when James Addiction was there. And Susie and the Banshees and Nine Inch Nails and Henry Rollins. I mean, this was the greatest thing. I remember the food because they had special food. So they had like the Rollins burger and a sushi and a Banshee, you know, these very clever things. So, and the iced tea. You know?
And this is when Lollapalooza would tour.
This is when I would tour.
Every city, right. I saw it at Alpine Valley or something like that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay.
I saw the second year with Ministry.
Oh.
That's the one where I'm like, okay, I'm done. I don't know. I don't know if this is for me.
Yeah, that's a lot.
It's like, it's dusk. Everyone is just moshing. Everything just got real Satan-y up in here. I think I'm gonna go wait in the car.
it's evolved so much.
Yeah.
But I've been covering it, you know, for the newspaper for years and years. And even the reps were like, oh yeah, Jerry's been with us since the beginning.
Okay, so when you say you covered for a newspaper, my question is, what are you looking to cover? Do you cover the experience? You cover the review the bands? Like, what is it that you want to focus on when you're a reporter covering Lollapalooza?
Yeah, I've been a big interviewer. So I interview a lot of the artists. I'm in the media area. It is kind of away from everything, the craziness. So I really enjoy that, just to kind of
Come over at a certain point and they'll do the rounds.
Yeah. And so I think that's fun. It was really fun to like people watch today. I had a great time.
Now, Pete and I were talking about this before the show started. It seems like the outfits and the fashion, now everyone knows they're being looked at. So there seems to be in 2019, more than ever, the outlandish and scantily clad, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
Teenagers that are coming out to knowing that they're going to make a scene.
There's a lot of skin out there, a lot of skin in the streets. So it's that's a lot to see. And I love it when they really step up and, you know, have the fringe going and the, you know, the long flowing, you know, gowns and whatever they want to do. So there's quite a variety out there. And the artists, you can spot some of these artists like a mile away.
Yeah,
so I love it when they really turn it out and really show up.
That's great. Last time I went 2 years ago, and we went and saw Chance the Rapper, and that was fun. But that also the scope of one of the headliners, like the headliner that's on right now, where we're getting close to the end of the night.
Yeah, the Strokes.
You look out and you will see thousands, 50,000, 100,000, whatever it is, the number. But to see the massive humanity in Grant Park, it's stunning. It blew my mind. It got me to a point where I had like chills. I'm like, I gotta get out of here.
Yeah. It's hard to describe to people too. I don't think they really get it until you go down, you see the miles and miles that's blocked off just for this thing.
Yeah.
And it's pretty wild. I like to bring my friends down whenever I can and just show them the world.